From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Some people are born to run, but everybody, it seems, is born to lie. We know that presidents lie, but so do we all. Kids lie about how the meatloaf went from their dinner plate to the dog's mouth. And we grow up. As we grow up, lies get messier with bigger consequences. Just ask anyone caught cheating on a spouse. There are whole publications dedicated to debunking lies that politicians tell. Gossip rags that catch celebrities in all kinds of lies. So why do we do it? This hour on Point, the science of why we lie. You can join us on air or online. Are you a white liar? Have you paid the price for lying? Is it ever okay to lie? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Udijit Bhattacharjee. He's an author and essayist who wrote a piece in the June issue of National Geographic called Why We Lie, The Science Behind Our Deceptive Ways. And there's some really interesting science in this article, by the way. You can read it at our website at onpointradio.org. And Udijit Bhattacharjee, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Thanks so much, Anthony. Glad to be here.
So, there's so much in this piece, and I just want to start with a really general question. What did you learn? What was the sort of big takeaway, the most surprising takeaway about lying and why we lie?
To me, the biggest surprise was how much we lie and how universal it is. Because, of course, as individuals, we know that we lie. But, you know, collectively, the fact that all of us lie and quite frequently, and that we're all adept liars, came as a surprise to me. And then the other surprising part was how gullible we are to fall for lies.
I'm so glad you put your finger right on this point, because this is the one that I was really itching to talk to you about. There's a great quote in here, and I've written down the quote, and forgive me, you'll probably tell me who it's from. Our capacity for dishonesty is as fundamental as our need to trust others, which makes us terrible at detecting lies. So there's a real irony there. We're great liars, but that makes us not very good at detecting lies.
That's correct, Anthony. It's kind of two sides of the same coin, if you think about it. We're so skilled at telling lies, and all of us are, that it just makes it all the more harder for us to then evaluate whether we're being lied to. So, you know, in a way, it's our own skill at lying, which collectively hampers our lie detection abilities.
Well, we're going to be talking about a lot of lies and lies that have been told down through history. But it's sort of hard to avoid, I guess you could say, the elephant in the room in this period of time. We've got a president. If you don't want to say he lies, he certainly says things that are sometimes not supported by the facts. So let's listen to an example. Here he is in a February interview, Donald Trump, with Fox News host Bill O'Reilly, which was broadcast shortly before the Super Bowl, and President Trump repeated this unfounded claim that 3 million illegal immigrants voted in the 2016 presidential election. Here is a bit of that exchange.
You take a look at the registration. You have illegals, you have dead people, you have this. It's really a bad situation. It's really bad. And
so you think you're going to be proven correct in that statement?
Well, I think I already have. A lot of people have come out and said that I am
correct.
Yeah,
but the data has to show that 3 million illegals voted.
Forget that. Forget all of that. Just take a look at the registration, and we're going to do it. And I'm going to set up a commission to be headed by Vice President Mike Pence, and we're going to look at it very, very carefully.
So there's Bill O'Reilly saying, yeah, but the data has to show that. And President Trump saying, no, forget that. Forget about the facts. So what do you hear in that exchange?
Well, you know, of course, that is not a claim that's been proved by any stretch of the imagination. And also to have Bill O'Reilly question it itself should tell you something about how believable that claim is. But what's interesting to me is that President Trump, when confronted and when asked, well, where's the proof, says, well, a lot of people have come out and said it. You know, and so the stuff or the evidence, the the purported evidence that he's marshaling to support that claim is basically other people repeating the lie. And that, I think, is what's most interesting about the era that we're living in. Because of social media, if you get enough people to believe a lie and then repeat it, well, sooner or later, it somehow kind of obscures that boundary between lies and the truth. And that boundary is a hard boundary. I mean, you can go out and count the number of people who may have voted illegally. And you know, and there's and everybody, I think, who's in the know would say that probably that number is in the tens or the dozens or, you know, or what have you, and certainly not on the scale that President Trump has claimed. And yet, if you have enough people saying, oh, no, well, you just don't know. You just don't know who's been voting illegally. You can somehow just muddy the waters enough so that that claim can linger on in public memory.
You did it. I want to play another cut of tape. This is from October 7th, an interview on HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher. Minnesota Democratic Senator Al Franken described the harmful effect of lying in politics. Here's a bit of what he said.
We're in a post-Trump era in terms of lying, and politicians don't seem to pay a penalty for insulting your intelligence with lies, lying about lying, lying for the sake of lying. You don't pay any price for that. In fact, it's just the opposite. We seem to be a very pro-lie society right now.
So there's Al Franken talking about politicians don't seem to be paying a penalty for insulting our intelligence and telling lies. Udigit, I want to make the point that it didn't start with this administration. We've had plenty of presidents who have lied pretty famously. Here's an example. Bill Clinton, January 1998, at a press conference at the White House, President Clinton denying allegations of an inappropriate relationship with a former White House intern, Monica Lewinsky.
I want to say one thing to the American people. I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Ms. Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never.
Well, we know that statement certainly wasn't substantiated by the facts. And you did it. Stay with me. But while we're on a roll talking about historic presidential lies, here's another one. November 1973, President Richard Nixon at a news conference addressing claims about kickbacks, unpaid income taxes, and the break-in at the Watergate Hotel the previous year. Here we are.
In all of my years of public life, I have never obstructed justice. And I think, too, that I can say that in my years of public life, that I welcome this kind of examination because people have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
Richard Nixon from November 1973. So you did it. I mean, interesting point. I mean, we are in an interesting era of alternative facts, but presidential lies certainly go back quite a ways, right?
That's absolutely correct, Anthony. I mean, lying didn't start with President Trump, and it's certainly not going to end with President Trump. Politicians in general lie. And as you prefaced our conversation with the statement, you know, all of us learn to lie. But there are people in power who will lie to retain power. And in those two clips that you just played, I mean, if you listen carefully, you'll notice how both of these presidents, President Nixon and then President Clinton, they were appealing sort of emotionally to the audience to believe them. You know, President Nixon says, in all my years of public life, which is basically to remind everyone that he has been serving the American public for years, and as if that is somehow supposed to earn, you know, credibility by itself, and that credibility should then be extended to the specific instance or the specific allegation that he's battling. Mm. In the same way, you have President Clinton saying, you know, I want you to listen to me real carefully. You know, I mean, these are just sort of ploys to kind of buy credibility. And I think politicians, as Al Franken says, they just have a special talent for appealing to the emotions of people in a way that makes them seem credible in the moment. And we live in a society where, you know, if their statements are proven to be untrue at a later point, they don't seem to pay a price at all. And more that seems to be the case.
And you make a great point in this article that one of the reasons for that, especially in the sort of political context, is, I mean, you can blame the politicians for sure because they're telling lies. That goes without saying. But I think there's a certain amount of gullibility on the part of a lot of people who continue to believe them if those lies conform with our worldview. Right. So, I mean, at that point, the listener has a certain responsibility in all this as well.
You're right, Anthony. The listener sort of becomes complicit in this lie. So it's almost like a conspiracy between the liar and the person being lied to. And in most cases, that happens when the lies seem to comfort us or fit a worldview that we believe in.
Right. Well, we're discussing lies and lying and the science of lying. We're going to get into that with Udit Bhattacharjee. He wrote a great piece in National Geographic. You can check that out at On Point Radio. Here's the British rock group Queen with Liar from their 1973 self-titled debut album. I'm Anthony Brooks, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about lying, why we do it, and some of the brain science behind it. We're going to get into that. You can join the conversation. What's going on in your head when you lie? Do you enjoy it or do you feel guilty? You can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And I'm talking with Udit Bhattacharjee. He's an author and essayist whose piece in the June issue of National Geographic is called Why We Lie, The Science Behind Our Deceptive Ways. And you can find it at our website on onpointradio.org. Udit, I just want to play a great cut from Eddie Izzard. This was from his 1998 stand-up special, Dressed to Kill. This is comedian Eddie Izzard. And this is in the era of Bill Clinton, President Bill Clinton, and his lies about an illicit affair. And Izzard seeks to put different kinds of lies into perspective. Here's what he said.
You grade murder, you have murder one, murder two. You realize that there can be a difference in the level of murder. So there must be a difference in the level of perjury. Perjury one is when you're saying there's no Holocaust when, you know, 10 million people have died in it. And perjury nine is when you said you shagged someone when you didn't. You know, it's...
So Eddie Izzard there. So let me start with that idea, Udit, different kinds of lies. I mean, how does that affect our willingness to tell lies, or what did you learn about that?
Well, there's a really nice pie chart in the story that kind of breaks down the various motivations for why we lie. You know, we lie to cover up our mistakes. We lie for economic advantage. We lie to kind of create an impression, even when an economic advantage is not at stake. So there's various reasons why we lie. And I guess in our own minds, we have rationalizations for every kind of lie that we tell. But some rationalizations are obviously, that they're more defensible than others. Mm-hmm. So, for example, lies that are told to spare the feelings of somebody else probably are at the level nine, to follow the same scale that or maybe even lower than that.
Yeah.
And then lies that we tell, to shareholders, if we're the CEO of a company and we're trying to, funnel money out of the company, these lies can be really hurtful because some shareholders might lose, so much money that they're left penniless, and so So there, you know, there are lies that husbands tell their wives or wives tell their husbands that could completely destroy a relationship and be disastrous for their families. And so obviously you have to kind of if we're in the business of sort of grading lies from like bad to really bad, then I guess the intent behind the lie and the consequence that the lie will have must be taken into account.
Let's go to Juan, who's calling from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Juan, you're on the air. Good to have you.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to the question of why people lie, I think it's very, very simple to just simply say it's due to self-interest. I have yet to find anyone who doesn't lie. I'll ask the people on the panel as well, everyone there, if you've ever lied and why have you lied, and you'll probably break it down fundamentally to self-interest, that it's about something you want to get out of what the action you're taking. And it's really about deceit. That's how I define lies. You may say something and you might not be well informed, and you'll say something and it may seem like a lie, but or you have a different perspective. And
well, Juan, let me push back just a little bit. I'm going to ask you about one other kind of lie, and it may sound sort of self-serving in certain situations, but what about lies to make people feel good? Do I look well today? Oh, you look wonderful. You know, that's a lie. That's not necessarily a self-interested lie, is it?
I don't know. Depends on do you do that to everyone, and does it matter if that person feels bad to you? If it doesn't matter how they feel and you still do it, then I guess it wouldn't be self-serving. But if you care how they feel at all and you do that, then I'd say there is self-interest involved there, because you take into their consideration how they feel.
Sure. Okay, Juan, you did it. What do you think about Juan's point, that it just really comes down, every lie comes down to self-interest?
Well, of course. I think that's a good point. And yet, you know, there's different kinds of self-interest. And so what the article discusses is, well, what are the various kinds of self-interest ultimately that motivate us to lie? And I think you were spot on when you pushed back and said, well, there are some lies that are not really told in self-interest, but are told to protect somebody else. And I think Juan's point is well taken, that even in those instances, you might actually have a situation where ultimately, the interest of that other person that you're trying to help is linked to your own interest. So, we are born liars. We learn to lie at an early age, and we continue to lie till the end of our lives. And some of our lies are egregious, and some of our lies are not so egregious.
So let me ask you about the brain science, which you get into this. And you, at a certain point, you call lying, learning to lie, a sort of developmental milestone in children. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, so by the age of 3 or 4, children will just start to tell lies as a matter of course. You know, they'll start to experiment with little lies. I didn't eat the cookie, or the dog ate the biscuit, or what have you. And so sometimes parents get concerned. My kid started to lie already, so young, and he's already lying. What's going to happen next? Well, relax, because being able to lie is a sign that that your child is developing what's known as theory of mind, which is the ability to read the intentions of other people. And so lying is sort of a testing of that theory in some ways. And so parents should not be concerned, because kids, you know, just naturally will start to lie between the ages of 3 and 5, and then they get better at lying with age, and by adolescence, you know, they're really pretty good at it.
And that's when you have to start worrying.
Well, I mean, you certainly have to watch the kinds of lies that are being told.
You did just listen to this. Here's a comedian, Louis C.K., talking about his daughter, dealing with his very young daughter and her lies. Here's what he said.
My 9-year-old, she's just figuring out about lying. And that's a tough thing. It's hard to roll that one back because lying is pretty amazingly useful in life. It's like, how do you tell a kid not to use a thing that just solves every possible problem? Like magic.
It's like magic. Raises a good point. How do you roll that one back? But I guess we take your advice, not to worry about it. Kids lie, and that just means their brains are developing normally.
Well, and you know, we aren't the best role models, you know, to our children because you know, at the age of 3, 4, I remember I told my son when he was 4 that or when he was 5 and started going to kindergarten that I had these special eyes that, you know, that I could use to see what he was doing at school. And, you know, about a year later, he came to me and asked me very earnestly, he said, "That isn't really true, is it?" And then I had to tell him a different lie, which was that, you know, it isn't true literally, but, you know, I still can tell what you've been doing at school just by kind of through inference. And of course, by now he's 11. He knows that even that second statement is not true.
Right. Let's take a few more calls. Katie is calling from Port Richey, Florida. Hi, Katie. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi. How are you?
Very well.
I wanted to go back to the tapes that you played about the president.
Sure.
To me, today it's different. Before, yes, all politicians lie, and people obviously all lie. Usually, though, it benefits you. It gets you out of something. It seems now that, like, lies, they don't benefit anybody. Like, you actually read some of these headlines or some of these tweets or whatever, and you're like, why even say that lie? Like, what, you know? And in the age of, you know, people being able to be so informed, it seems like people are, like, the most misinformed now. You know, I have the ability to just Google if that's what somebody said is true or not. But instead, people read it in one spot, or even I can give you, like, a microcosm. Like, at work, I work in law enforcement and policy and procedure. If I say something and then somebody else overhears it and we both say it, whether it's true or not, whether it's in policy and procedure, people take it as fact and run with it.
That's really interesting, Katie. Why do you think that is? I mean, Katie makes a really interesting point about the way lying is used and perceived now as being different than before. And I know you write about this as well, that we're sort of entering new frontiers of sort of truthlessness or absence of fact. And it makes the whole issue around lying a little more corrosive, a little more troubling in our public life.
Katie raises a really good question, and I think that she might have been referring to, you know, Trump's claim that that, you know, 3 million or 5 million people voted illegally in the election. So if you look at this pie chart in the story, there's one particular little segment where the motivation for lying is just narcissism. You know, where people just want to feel good, they want to show that, you know, that they're better, even though there may not be anything to gain, you know, for President Trump. There's nothing to be gained by saying, well, you know, I could have, you know, I may actually have won the election by a far greater margin than you think, or what have you. So I do think that we're in a very interesting time where you could technically Google and debunk a lie as it's being spoken on national television. And yet, you know, there are now websites that are also sprouting to support those very lies. Mm-hmm. So even online, you know, it's starting to become hard to tell fact from fiction, you know, especially when the stakes are really high. You know, it may be the case that you Google something and the answer is clear, and yet there's all this conflicting information, and you end up wanting to believe whatever set of facts, you know, I hate to use the word alternative facts, but whatever set of facts suits your prejudiced opinion of
right.
the world.
Once again, we accept the lies that affirm our worldview, and it seems easier and easier to find evidence of those facts or of those alternative facts to support your worldview. Let's go to John, who's calling from Detroit. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure, happy to do it.
Wow, this is a great conversation. I just had several of these with friends and family about the little lies that we're taught from very early. The Easter Bunny, Santa Claus, the Tooth Fairy. And again, you know, how does this dress look on me? And we are taught from a very early age to lie. And then there's organized religion and this whole thing about the afterlife. And it's all, you know, it's all made up. And it's all made up for a variety of reasons, I feel. One is commerce and one is just to sedate your children, you know, with...
Did you say what to sedate your children? Is that what you said, John?
Yeah, you know what?
Wait a minute, John. Are you telling me that the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy don't exist? I mean, no one has ever laid that out to me so honestly, and
I'm
devastated. I need a glass of water.
Let's remember that devastation when we do find out, because usually it's a bully at school that tells us the truth, and then we're conflicted whether it's not a truth or is a truth, and we run home to mom and ask them, and then they're stuck with unfurling the lies.
No, John, I think you raise a good point. I was sort of teasing you, but you did it. I think John raises a really good point because it is an incredibly inconsistent set of messages we give our kids, because we tell them all the time, and they are told all the time that you must tell the truth, but then we shower them with lies from the time they wake up until the time we put them to bed, with promises of tooth fairies and Easter bunnies and Santa Claus and everything else.
That's right. We tell them, you know, make sure to tell grandma that you really like the socks
right.
that she gave you for Christmas, even if you hate them. So it's, you know, I think, you know, children are, you know, they're complex, you know, creatures just like us, and as they develop into adults, you know, they learn more and more about the world. And I think these lies, like the Easter Bunny, the existence of the Easter Bunny or Santa Claus, I think ultimately they come to a point where they know that it's a lie, but they know that it was told to them to kind of create this magical kingdom for them in childhood, so that they could draw comfort from it, so that they could be excited about it. And I think, you know, they don't – I doubt that influences their lying culture, or them to develop a lying culture as they go forward. I think they can make a distinction between those kinds of lies and the kinds of lies that they themselves start telling to get out of trouble. I think that it's a very interesting phenomenon that we have created ways in which we can kind of escape from reality in order to feel good. And we're using those same talents when we're telling lies, you know, creating alternative realities for others to manipulate them.
Really interesting. We're discussing dishonesty. We're talking about lying and some of the scientific and sociological reasons why we lie. Here are the Black Eyed Peas with Don't Lie from their 2005 triple platinum album, Monkey Business. We'll be back in a minute. We're going to take a short break. I'm Anthony Brooks, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service you've heard about. Its mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to all. They support a more sustainable food system, set the highest standards for ingredients, and make it easy and fun to cook. You decide which recipes and how many meals you want each week. Change, pause, or cancel anytime. Learn more at blueapron.com/onpoint. Go now and get your first 3 meals free plus free shipping at blueapron.com/OP.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about dishonesty, deception, and some of the reasons why we lie. You can join the conversation. Is lying inevitable? Is it inherently bad? I'm talking with Udijit Bhattacharjee. He's written a piece in the June issue of National Geographic called Why We Lie, The Science Behind Our Deceptive Ways. And you can find a link to that very interesting piece at onpointradio.org. And Udijit, I'd like to go straight back to the calls. Let's go to Michael, who is calling from Fort Lauderdale. Michael, good to have you on the show.
Hi, Anthony.
Hi there. What's on your mind?
You know, we've talked about how, you know, liars are inherently bad or bad people, but I realized that I was gay when I was 9, but I also knew that I needed to lie about it. I needed to see people, not only for my emotional safety, but sometimes my physical safety. I didn't want to go to hell, and I just grew up that lying was the easier path that led to stealing and lying about it, led to cheating, led to, you know, plagiarizing in college, leading from relationship to relationship because I didn't know what emotional honesty was. What's the science behind how to move a habitual liar that's not lying for any fault of their own into a healthy place?
That's a great and deep question. Michael, thank you so much for the call. Udijit, do you want to take a stab at Michael's question?
That's a profound question, and I'm sorry, Michael, that you've had to endure all of these troubles since childhood. But I think, you know, there's a little section in the piece that talks about how small lies can become a gateway to bigger lies, and so I think I understand what Michael's saying when he says that, you know, that habit of lying to keep himself safe from childhood on, sort of led him to tell other lies.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have a good answer as to how you can take a person like that and then kind of dial back their lying habit. But I guess there might be support groups out there of people who are just kind of habitual liars and want to get better and don't want to reflexively tell lies. But there's no evidence that there's really a condition called habitual lying or pathological lying, even though we use that term. There's no mental illness that directly corresponds to lying all the time. So it may be more of a habit that forms over time rather than a condition.
Well, let me introduce from Birmingham, Alabama, Tim Levine. He's a professor and the chair of communication studies at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. And he spent decades researching deception and how to detect it. And Tim Levine, thanks for joining us on Point in this really interesting conversation with Udijit Bhattacharjee. Good to have you.
Hi, Anthony.
I'm wondering, not to put you on the spot, but we had a really sort of powerful question from Michael, who talked about developing a habit of lying to essentially keep himself safe, that led him to tell bigger lies and led to problems in relationships. And he asked the question, you know, how do you dial something like that back?
That's a difficult question. So the reason most people lie is because the truth is some kind of problem for them. And in the case of the caller, it sounded like the truth actually was physically dangerous for them. So probably the best suggestion is to not put yourself in situations where the truth might be risky.
Right. Now, tell me a little bit about your research, which focuses on human detection, and you describe it as a sort of true-false test. You're determining whether or not people are lying, and your findings show that people are inclined to believe something much more often than they're not. Why is that?
I think it's because people are just social, and we spend our time with other people, and communication is very important to us. And if you can't trust what other people say, then that just really undercuts all the benefits of communication.
Yeah. Does that sound right to you, Udigit?
Yeah, and actually it does, because I interviewed Tim extensively for this piece. Tim is a fantastic interview, and in fact, a lot of the elements in the story come directly from Tim's research. And the thing that Tim was describing to you right now about why we trust others, Tim actually developed a theory called the truth default theory, which is that we accept what we're told or what we hear, or what we come across as the truth. And there's an evolutionary sort of explanation for that. You know, we live in a society where we're constantly dependent on other people for information. You know, you don't go to the internet for everything. I mean, the internet is a recent phenomenon, and also don't believe everything you see on the internet, by the way. But it's just a requirement of living in society to be able to trust what other people are telling us. So we're just programmed to believe, you know, and that's why we end up falling for lies without scrutinizing them. I mean, just imagine what you know, if somebody came up to you and said, "Hi, I'm so and so." You know, you wouldn't respond with like, "Oh, really? Are you? Let me see your driver's license." You know, you wouldn't do that. You would just say, "Oh, hi, Tim. How are you doing?" You know, when Tim says he's a professor at the university in Alabama, you know, you don't start looking him up online to make sure that he has a website. And if Tim really weren't a professor, you know, he might think two steps ahead of you and set up a fake website. So it's really a function of our trusting nature that you know, that Tim has very eloquently sort of encapsulated in this theory.
And Tim, you know, as someone who has looked at this for a long, long time, earlier in the hour we were talking about you know, this conversation has particular resonance in this moment in history because of the conversations around fake news and alternative facts and all kinds of websites and the ability for people to find the lies that conform with their worldview. I'm just curious what you make of that, given that the research that you do. Do you see these as particularly troubling times around this issue?
I do, and I'm very worried that all these alt facts are going to erode trust in our society and in our institutions. And you know, I'm worried that democracy doesn't work that well if we become cynical of all our people running for office. And if we come increasingly polarized, and if we believe all the other people who don't share our beliefs are just lying, then I don't see how we can work together and to accomplish goals. So I find this very troubling.
Well, let's go back to the phones. Anne is calling from Lake George, New York. Anne, you're on the air. It's good to have you.
Oh, hi, Anthony.
Hi there. Tell me what's on your mind.
I don't think that children are born liars. I think a child lies because their parents don't tell them not to lie. I think when you lie to someone, you insult them because you deceive them. I think that, you know, childhood fantasies like, you know, the Easter Bunny and, you know, Santa Claus, I think those are not lies. I thought they're just innocent childhood fantasies. There are big lies. You can lie to someone and you can, like, wreck their life. You can wreck their whole life with one lie.
Yeah, but go back to that idea that children aren't born liars, because Udigit or Tim, chime in here. I mean, for what I took away from Udigit's piece is there's sort of brain science that suggests that we are sort of born with a tendency to say things that aren't true.
This is Tim. I want to agree with the caller that we're not born liars. I think the research is pretty clear before age three. Children can say things that are false, but they really don't have the theory of mind to really deceive other people.
Hmm.
And so it's not something we're born with. It's something that we're born to develop once we hit ages 3 to 5 or so.
That's really interesting. So Anne, thanks for putting that idea on the table there. Udigit, I'm interested in this. It's something I want to ask you, and Tim, chime in as well. But just the idea of how different cultures treat lying. And Udigit, if I have it right, you're of Indian descent. Did you grow up in India? I mean, as you wrote this piece, were you aware of sort of cultural differences from one continent to the other?
Well, I didn't think about that too much while writing the story, although I did come across research that showed, specifically Dan Ariely's research showing that on all these tests of dishonesty that he carried out, he's a Duke University scientist that I quote in the story. In all of these tests that he and his group ran around the world, they sort of found found similar results. You know, there wasn't a big difference in sort of the tendency to lie or the kinds of lies that people were saying or the tendency to cheat. It was pretty much the same. But obviously, there are differences between cultures, and this is something that I reflected on after the piece came out. For example, I know that in India, if you ask somebody for directions on the street, they will never tell you that they don't know. I mean, they will, you know, that's probably not an exaggeration, but they will, in all likelihood, they will say, well, you know, go here or take a right, take a left, even when they don't know, because they don't want to seem unhelpful. And so that's one kind of lie. I spent 26 years in India before I came to this country, and I've lived here for almost 20 years now. And I know that in American culture, people say things like when they don't like something, they won't directly say they don't like it. They'll say something like, well, I thought it was interesting, you know, which is a code word for, well, I don't really like it. Not always, but in some cases.
Yeah.
And also, you know, in American culture, I've found that people are more adept at lying by omission, you know, rather than than explicitly lying. You know, they might tell you, you know, out of a universe of 10 things that you need to know, you know, they might tell you, three or four things, and then they won't tell you the remaining five. The line at the end of some of these ads for drugs where they say, at a very rapid clip, they'll read out all of the side effects, the terrible side effects that a drug might cause. That's like, okay, they're stating all of those because they want to be truthful, but really they don't want you to comprehend all of that. And that's a form of dishonesty.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. Let's take a couple more calls. Jim is calling from Essex, Massachusetts. Jim, you're on the air. Good to have you.
Yeah, it's interesting hearing this conversation because lying has always been important to me since I was a kid, because when I was in third grade at my Catholic school back in Michigan, I wanted to be popular when I got to third grade, and so I would lie a lot, and I would say something to one boy, and then the next day another boy would come up to me and say, oh, I heard you know so-and-so, and they'd say, I'd say, no, I don't, and only then did I realize, oh, I must have lied, and I couldn't remember all my lies, the whole tangled web we weave, and so at that age, I thought, I gotta stop this lies, it's not getting me anywhere, and so I personally am from Russian extraction, because there is a cultural piece, I believe, that is part of all of this. But my life has simply been based on telling the truth. And what I realized is when I don't want to, I'm really afraid of, oh, they're not going to like me. Oh, they're going to hit me. Oh, and I just got to get over the fear and deal with it. And my life has been easier not lying. And it's interesting to me that this topic hasn't really been part of this conversation, so I'm glad to bring that up.
Well, Jim, thanks. We appreciate you bringing it up. What do you hear in Jim's call? But this idea of being trapped in a web of lies and then figuring out a way out of it sounds important and therapeutic and a sort of good note, a good sort of final note in this conversation.
It is, and he's right. It's not a part of this piece, in the magazine, but it's certainly a part. I'm glad that it's become a part of this conversation. What I hear in his words is that the truth does set us free. You know, in many situations, we go in. I mean, we know that the cover up is often worse than the mistake because, you know, if you readily admit to the first lie that you've told, you're better off than weaving a whole web of lies at the end of which there's just the abyss. So it definitely, you know, it resonates with me, the idea that if you do practice honesty, then, you know, in spite of ourselves, in spite of our lying nature, we might be better off.
Well, Udijit Bhattacharjee is an author and an essayist who wrote a long piece in the June issue of National Geographic called Why We Lie, The Science Behind Our Deceptive Ways. Thank you so much for joining us today, Udijit. It was a pleasure talking to you, and thank you for the piece.
Thank you so much, Anthony.
And Tim Levine, a communications professor at the University of Alabama in Birmingham, who studies lying and deception. Glad to have you with us as well. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
And listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.
Do, it's who you are.